This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, this year saw no shortage of science, medicine, and technology news, and much of it was on the front pages of your local newspapers. Here are just some of the stories. I'm going to run down just a few of them. There's so many from the past years. Remember, there's the global warming stories, and probably the biggest global warming story is the publication of Al Gore's best-selling book, An Inconvenient Truth, which hit the silver screen in May, and it was also a bestseller on the New York Times list. New studies were projecting that by the year 2040, the summer ice in the Arctic Ocean would be a thing of the past. And we just heard this week the U.S. Department the U.S. government put the polar bear on the endangered species list, or is thinking about it. It may, even without listing it, it may go the way of the dodo. So polar bear is endangered, whether we want to officially call it that or not. In anthropology, we have researchers able to actually pluck DNA from Neanderthal fossils and then analyze the DNA and sequence it, hopefully answering some of the questions about the connection between Neanderthals and modern humans. We had E. coli outbreaks and bacterial outbreaks of other types that left scientists struggling to identify the sources of tainted food. The public is left wondering whether they look at their salad at the salad bar now, whether their food supply is safe. We had a paralyzed man equipped with a brain sensor who was able to open email and move a robotic hand simply by thinking about it. Very interesting story. We had the first ever cancer vaccine, which was approved. It protects women and girls from infections from the human papillomavirus, which causes most cases of cervical cancer. And one of my favorite stories is that the state of Texas passed California as the king of wind energy, completing a trend that was set in place by none other than Texas Governor George W. Bush, who does not, you know, right? Wind energy is high on his list of things for the country while he did as a governor. It's interesting. This hour, we're going to review a lot of these stories, a lot of the top science, medical, and technology stories of the year. We'll hear why the solution of a longstanding math problem grabbed top honors as a breakthrough of the year at Science Magazine. And we'll also talk about some of the infamous stories like the South Korean cloning scandal that was the breakdown of the year. So what stories top your lists? Give us a call, 1-800-989-8255. Maybe we're going to miss one. I'm sure there are lots of stories. We can't cover them all. Maybe there's a seminal one that you think we should put on that list that you're not hearing us talking about. Maybe one flew under the radar on this. And you can always surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Our phone number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. We have an August panel of commentators. So August, we may go into September on this. I'm sorry about that one. John Rennie is the editor-in-chief at Scientific American here in New York, and he joins us here in our Science Friday studios in New York. Welcome back, John. Good to see you.
Good year.
Baron H. Lerner, Dr. Lerner, is the author of When Illness Goes Public, Celebrity Patients and How We Look at Medicine. It's published this year from Johns Hopkins University Press. He is professor of medicine and public health at Columbia University's Medical Center, Mailman School of Public Health here in New York, very famous place. He joins us today in our studios here in New York. Welcome to the program. Welcome
Thank you,
back,
Ira.
Dr. Lerner. Casey Cole is a science commentator for KPCC in Pasadena. She's a visiting professor of journalism at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. She's probably one of the great translators of physics, and I'm very happy to have Casey back joining us from KCRW in Santa Monica. Good to talk to you again, Casey. Adam Rogers is a senior editor at Wired Magazine in San Francisco and correspondent for the upcoming PBS television show Wired Science. He joins us today by phone from, I'm sure it's a vacation locale with plenty of screaming children and relatives in Arroyo Grande, California. Thanks for being with us, Adam.
Thank you for pegging my mother-in-law's house perfectly accurate.
Well, let's give you a shot before people get aware that you're on the radio. Tell us what would be one of your top picks, Adam, this year?
Well, I guess I'll voice some of the tech stuff first, just mm-hmm. give props to the Wired side and talk a little bit about Google and YouTube. I'm not trying to make that into a business story, but I do think that it's important and interesting for the future of the internet that the king of searching for stuff on the internet is now has now purchased the king of watching little bits of video on the internet. I think that presages a total change in the way people consume television and media, and I think it presages what's going to happen to the internet in the next year too, assuming Google can figure out some key technological issues.
Are you saying we're seeing the death of TV this year might mark that as we know it?
Well, I do think it's a bit of a, you know, television is dead, long live television. I think mm-hmm. people are, I think what we're seeing with things like YouTube and other places to watch short squibs of video online is that nobody any longer wants to sit in front of a television at a specific place for a specific time. TiVo means the same thing, right? All of the sort of time shifting that we can do now includes media shifting or medium shifting, I guess, from television to computer to iPod to whatever you want to watch it on, and in shorter bites than just a half hour or an hour. And with people making their own. I mean, the key thing about YouTube, of course, is not just being able to watch, you know, Star Wars kids playing with, you know, special effect lightsabers or watching bits of the Jon Stewart show from the night before, but being able to put your own videos on it, too. So, you know, people making their own television. I don't want to give too much of a shout-out to another magazine, but I think that's some of what Time meant when they put when they made you the person of the year. Mm-hmm. That's that the sort of crowdsourcing of content on the internet is something that we saw more and more this year, and I think we're going to see more and more next year, people making their own stuff, and that being the television that people consume via YouTube, via Google, right?
Well, what is the big deal over Google taking that over?
Well, I think what interests me about it, like I said, the business stuff I don't particularly care too much about. What interests me is that, you know, right now, if you're going to search for something, you Google it, right? It is a verb, the same way that when we copy things, we Xerox them. It is the default search engine for the web. But the one thing that nobody really knows how to do online is search for video. You can search for sort of tags on video. You can search for things that people have told you the video is about, right? But there's no way to search for, I want to see pictures of the following. And my kind of sort of prediction, sort of hope, sort of guess is that if anybody's going to be able to figure out how to search video, it's Google.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. John, give us one of your top picks.
Well, I think probably from Scientific American standpoint, probably the most important story overall was the one you were referring to that falls under the general heading of what's been learned about global warming and mm-hmm. developments in that area. Looking back over this past year, it's not that there was any one particular story that most stood out. It's the continuing trend of obviously the ongoing validation that global warming is a very real problem, that it is one caused in no small way by what human activity is doing by putting more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and the fact that sort of the political standpoint that unfortunately the United States has really not shown the kind of leadership that it should in dealing with this problem seriously.
Mm-hmm. So the story is just that this is, would you say that the U.S. has finally bought on to this now, or are we still?
You know, it's funny that what we're seeing is it's an incremental buy into this. The very encouraging things that happened this past year, for example, were, as you mentioned, Al Gore's movie An Inconvenient Truth. I think that helped to convince a lot more people who'd maybe been on the fence previously mm-hmm. that global warming is a very real problem and that something has to be done about it. You know, maybe that's one of those sort of tipping point phenomena. Another one, I think, is that we're starting to see the business community is starting to respond. We mentioned that end of year we have our own Scientific American 50 list in which we're acknowledging different technology leaders. Mm-hmm. And our business leader of the year was actually the Swiss reinsurance company, Swiss Re, because they have been encouraging a lot of the business community to try to factor global warming strategies into their long-term planning. But I think we can even see some sorts of movement, at least even within the administration. If nothing else, the fact that the Interior Department now seems to be willing to recognize that polar bears are endangered by the loss of their Arctic habitat.
Yeah, Casey Cole, what have you got on your list?
Well, in terms of physics, I would say mostly things that haven't been covered very much. I was surprised that there's so little being said about the preparations for the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, that will become the world's most powerful particle accelerator late this year, next, because what's happening is people are trying to figure out what could possibly be seen, extra dimensions being one of them, new families of particles being another, all kinds of exotic stuff, mini black holes. If you don't really work out what you might see and what the signature of it would be, then you won't see it if it's not right in front of your nose. So a lot of it has been about clever new ways of actually looking for invisible things. In math, of course, as you said, I was delighted to see that science put the Poincaré conjecture as number one. What I find fascinating about this is that there are all these problems in math that can be solved in dimensions one and two and dimensions five or higher. If you want to tie a nine-dimensional knot in ten-dimensional space, no problem. But dimensions three and four are very, very complicated, and there are these whole class of problems that haven't been solved. So this was quite an important breakthrough, and of course important for us in a way because we live in three dimensions, four-dimensional space-time, and so there's a lot of overlap between math and physics in these areas. And I can say more about this if you like. But
well, it was so important that it was made the number one story.
Yes.
That, I mean, I think it's hard for the public to understand how important that might be, that of all the stories, that one was chosen. Why was that? Can you give us a little more of that flavor?
Well, there are a lot of things, yeah, that are fairly typical of the way things happen in math and also science in general. Somebody finds a solution to a problem which other people have found pieces of before and then puts it together in a new, unique way that eventually right. everyone looks at and says, yeah, well, of course. Let me just state what simply the problem is that he solved. If you're living in a certain kind of space, basically, how do you know what its shape is? And by shape, I don't mean geometric shape, but shape, like, does it have holes in it? You know, they joke that a topologist is someone who doesn't know the difference between a donut and a coffee cup, which is true, because the only thing that matters is that it has one hole. So you're basically defining families of kinds of objects in space, just like biologists do. Mathematicians do basically the same thing in terms of classifying. So
Casey,
the question was...
Casey, wait, I want you to hold that question, because we have to take a break, and I want to get to give you time to tell us what that question was, and we'll be back. We'll be back with all our guests talking about the big science, math, technology stories of the year. Also bring on our other guests to give us their ideas, so stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the top science, health, medicine, technology, mathematics, you know, stories of 2006. Running them down with my guests, John Rennie, Baron Lerner, Casey Cole, and Adam Rogers. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. And when I rudely interrupted Casey, as I want to do to all of my guests, she was explaining why the top prize for this year in Science Magazine was a mathematics prize. You're
right.
About to tell us the significance.
Okay. What I was trying to explain was that this gave you a way of basically figuring out what kind of topological space you live in, even though you're embedded in it, which is a very difficult thing to do. You might ask what possible practical application this kind of thing could have. Well, as usual, it's a lot of the tools that were developed leading up to it will become very important. For example, they teach us things about singularities, you know, those nasty things at the hearts of black holes that pinch off space-time. And they pop up as problems all over the place in physics and math. So this is actually given a way to figure out whether or not they're there. Basically, you imagine a space. If it's a sphere, you can tie a string around it and pull it closed, and you won't encounter any resistance. If it's got a hole in it and you do the same thing, you pull the string, it will not. It will get stuck. And so it's a mathematical way of seeing the topology of the space that you're living in.
Thank you. Baron Lerner, what would be your pick?
I guess one story that you didn't mention was surrounding breast cancer. And interestingly, this year, the rates of breast cancer for the last year that we have data, which is 2003, showed a major drop of 7% of the new cases of the disease. And this was very striking because for years and years, for reasons that people couldn't explain, the rate of breast cancer was either staying the same or creeping up. And there were a lot of different hypotheses as to why that was happening. And then all of a sudden, we see this very significant 7% drop. And now it's being speculated that the reason for that is that women have stopped taking hormone replacement therapy because of all the negative publicity about that. Mm-hmm. So that was very, very striking, because this would suggest that for years and years, it was the medicine that was being given to treat the symptoms of menopause that indeed was causing more harm than good.
But it was certainly good news. I mean, what they said, 40,000 deaths were averted?
Exactly. Like, I mean, it's very exciting news. And one would expect that this decline will continue because more and more women have gotten off hormone replacement therapy based on the study results.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones and get some listeners in. Tony in Nevada City, California. Hi, Tony.
Good morning. Yeah, the great show. I have it on the pod and listen to you as often as I can. So one of the things that I don't think you covered this year was the imaging of dark matter. And you can see a great picture of this at a site called badastronomy.com. And they did it through the use of gravitic lenses.
Yeah, it was the collision of two, like the bullet picture, I think it was called. Right, Casey?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and that's another great example of people being clever about how to figure out how to see something that you can't see, dark matter being essentially transparent, so it doesn't interact with anything. So, you know, they figured out, well, if two galaxies collide, the way that the matter clumps with each other is going to be different than the way the dark matter does, and therefore it will be distributed differently. And bingo, they went out and looked for it, and they found it.
That's interesting. John, one of the biggest stories of the year, I mean, we don't think about it, but what we remember is that Pluto getting kicked out of the planetary lineup, right?
Right. You know, it's funny. This is probably, in many respects, not the biggest or most important science story in a lot of ways, but it probably grabbed the public's imagination more than almost anything else. And it is a it is a development that actually does have some real scientific importance to it. You know, there's been this question for quite some time when we were looking at Pluto as a sort of very small, oddball planet out sort of toward the edge of the solar system, and the question of, should it really be a planet? And its position has been steadily undermined by the discovery of more and more things out in the Kuiper Belt, the ring of icy bodies out farther out in the solar system, some of which are now actually even larger than Pluto. So the decision was that this should actually be sort of relegated to a kind of dwarf planet status. And I'll take the maybe publicly unpopular opinion that I think they made the right call on this. Because I think in terms of what we actually know these days about the science of how planets form, demoting Pluto is actually more in keeping with that science, even though it's a very sentimentally unpopular position to take.
Yeah. Hopefully this will teach Pluto not to miss meetings.
Casey,
I would like
go ahead.
To offer a counter argument, if I can. This business of recategorizing things and renaming them. I mean, historically, we have so many silly names. We call electrons, we say they have negative charge, even though it's a positive presence of something, just because people didn't understand at first that this was a presence instead of an absence. We draw these lines. The objects out in space come in a complete continuous spectrum of sizes, and it's very difficult to tell sometimes whether you're dealing with a planet, a failed star. I mean, they're not these clear lines, and when we put them out there, we imagine. It reminds me a little bit of that old Arthur Eddington joke where the astronomer gives a talk to a lay audience about stars, and somebody asks him after, well, I understood how you find out about the temperatures of stars and how you found out how hot they were and so forth. One thing I didn't understand. What's that? He says, well, how did you find out their names? And but, in a way, that's what we're doing.
But, you know, well, nomenclature was a big story this year in a lot of places, right? I mean, didn't the medical and biomedical community got busted for coming up with silly names for genes because now they're having medical applications as well, and nobody wants to tell a patient that they have a problem with their Sonic the Hedgehog gene?
No one beats physicists with silly names.
That's true.
You know, up, quark, charm, all this kind of stuff like that. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Wayne in Flagstaff. Hi, Wayne.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi there.
Good. You might think, being from Flagstaff, Arizona, that my top story would be Pluto being demoted, but here in Flagstaff, Pluto will always remain a planet.
There you go.
My top story, believe it or not, was the decision by New York City to outlaw trans fats And, of course, all science stories are important, but for some reason this really captured my imagination and my interest. And I just love seeing it when entities like a city like New York or even a country like Denmark completely outlaw things that only serve to benefit financially corporations, but everybody knows that trans fats and things like that are bad for us. And that really captured my attention this year.
Baron?
That's it was quite a story, and it's still an ongoing one. It really speaks to the degree to which we as a country want public health officials to be very aggressive about telling us what to do or what not to do. I think in this case, it's a definite positive advance because trans fats, it turns out, really do not much of any good for anybody and do a lot of harm. There were some very important studies on monkeys this year that showed just a small amount of trans fats cause arterial plaque buildup and other problems. So if we want public health officials who are going to be very aggressive and take on business and take on people who want a more libertarian approach, we're going to see more and more things like this in the future.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling.
We want to ban smoking. Sorry.
1-800-999-8255 is our number. We're talking about the top stories of 2006. And then what about all these video games and the melding of I was fortunate enough to get a Wii for the holidays.
Oh, did you wait in line for it, or did you?
No, I had an inside the store connection.
Nice.
By my cousin's girlfriend, my nephew's girlfriend, so to speak.
It's always good.
But
to be
I'm addicted to it now, and because it's so different. And now I notice that there's a Wi-Fi connection on it that allows me to go to the web through my Wii, and it will allow me to play things with other people on the web and download other things. Like, it seems like they want a piece of what Apple seems to want, which is making that one device that's going to combine all the media.
Yeah, first of all, let me just say you're doomed now. You're never leaving the house again. get replacement hosts. You're in trouble.
I'm only on level one of Zelda, so I'm pretty well intact, you know.
Here's what fascinates me about the Wii. So the Wii is the new Nintendo system. It's this very small little white box. It looks very much like an Apple design, right? It's a little kind of white thing. Sits very prettily, glows blue next to your television. This is the first gaming system. I'm not a huge gamer, but you know, we got one in the office, and I went and tried it out. It's the first one that I've seen that made me think this is the thing that adults will take out at parties.
Yeah.
This is a system that is designed to not be used by sort of a Halo obsessive, you know, who's going to sit in front of a really, really high-end, you know, $600 system like what the PlayStation 3 is and kind of be there for hours and hours and really gawp at how great the, you know, cinematic quality of the graphics and, you know, how great the blood explosions look because of the new physics engine. This is a system where, you know, the game that I tried out was the tennis game.
Oh, I love the tennis.
It's fantastic. And on the Wii, so the graphics are very cartoonish, intentionally so, because it's simple, right? But the controllers are motion sensitive and wireless. So, you know, you stand there and you play tennis as if the controller was your racket. You flick your wrist to hit a ball. And it's really compelling. I mean, it's like Tetris compelling. Because it's really fun, and you sort of stand there with another person standing next to you, and you're making kind of charades like gesticulations and trying to win a doubles tennis match. It really was kind of a journey back to simplicity for video games, for computer games, which is totally the opposite direction that most gamers, most game systems, most game software makers are headed. You know, it's almost like the difference between the Airbus A380, the giant, you know, double decker. 600 people flies around the world, and Boeing's little 787 that's a smaller plane, more efficient, bigger windows, sort of a nicer experience. The Wii is just a really pleasant experience as a game, and that's it's something that as people get more and more serious about the games, I have a suspicion that they get less fun. The Wii is actually more fun.
You actually hold all the sports equipment like you do in real life. I mean, there's the controller. They show you how to hold in the golf game. You have to hold it like a golf club, stand sideways to the screen, and swing like the club, and someone imitates it on the screen.
Bend your knees, keep your back straight.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and it's just baseball. It's just hard. Somebody's throwing a 95-mile-an-hour fastball at you, and you have to hold the thing like a bat. So you really, I think, as you say, you actually are part of the game instead of just using your thumb to manipulate it like you do in the other controllers. It's just quite amazing.
This is such an important thing that's going on now with the kind of computers and the online. I think this year was really the first year where you could seriously talk about online worlds and not be totally geeking out. I mean, places like EverQuest and World of Warcraft and Second Life and The Sims all really became places people go. You know, just as much as San Luis Obispo is a place that people go.
Yeah.
You know, and that, and that's a profound change in the way people, I think, interact with each other, and sort of think about themselves and their own personalities and where they are in space and time.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Another, I guess, watershed event, Casey, that happened is this political situation that has affected science this year, and now the switch, possibly, because the Democrats are coming back into power.
I'm glad you brought that up. I was afraid to, because I know the last time I was on, I talked about that a lot. But, yeah, what's interesting is it's finally gotten to the point where the scientists are fighting back and saying enough manipulation, enough wasted money going in really silly programs like the Moon to Mars mission, for example, which is just devastating many, many other fields. And they are getting politicized. They found this founded the Scientists and Engineers for America, an organization that's actually raising money to run advertising, supporting candidates in various fields, because it's gotten to that tipping point where people just could not stand anymore the fact that science does not seem to have an ear these days in Washington.
Mm-hmm. John Rennie, you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's what's unfortunate is that because the scientists have now had to get sucked into a political process where they have to speak up to defend what should be rational courses of action and the rational interpretation of the scientific findings, it's that, unfortunately, it does make it possible for people who oppose some of the sorts of actions they'd like to see, for example, global warming deniers and the like, to be able to maintain that the scientists themselves just represent their own kind of interest group, their own lobby. And that, I think, has a very corrosive effect on the way that the public views science, and there's going to be a lot of damage that's been done by the people who've been opposing this.
Talking about the top stories in science this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Hi, Barron, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I just was going to echo that in the world of medicine when Michael J. Fox wound up doing political ads in favor of candidates who were doing stem cell research because of his Parkinson's disease. Mm-hmm. And that was another very interesting mixture of politics and science where, you know, I think Michael J. Fox was out there as a Parkinson's patient first and foremost saying, I want to scientists to be able to explore whatever they can. But at least the folks on the Republican side assumed that this was all a political ploy, which I really think it wasn't.
Mm-hmm. We also saw the states scientifically taking on the federal government.
Right. I think, you know, this is an interesting point. It's the caller who was mentioning the way that New York City was taking this action on its own with trans fats. I mean, I think it's been very interesting to see the counter reaction to that you've seen. For example, California try to take leadership on both stem cell research and also in global warming by setting its own greenhouse gas emission standards.
Casey?
Well, I was going to say one of the most dangerous places dangerous ways is what you might call faith-based science has been affecting us is in terms of national security. We're spending billions and billions of dollars on a missile defense system, which virtually, you know, very tiny percentage of the physics community even think could possibly work. But just in terms of general reports that scientific organizations have come out with telling us what makes sense to do is not what we're doing in almost every case. We're just not basing these decisions on how to spend dollars in any rational, sane way. In fact, even trans fats, I was joking about the cigarettes, but even the dangers we tend to go after in the medical field, a lot of times just don't make sense compared to other risk factors. Mm-hmm. It would be nice if we had a rational way of mm-hmm. going out and really deciding what's dangerous and how to approach that.
Well, you know, but
go ahead.
Ira, at the top of the show, you mentioned some of the food safety stories that we've seen this year and how, you know, people sort of get a little nervous in the salad bar because you don't know whether the food you're looking at has E. coli in it or something like that. And it occurred to me that what we were told that sort of publicly after the anthrax attacks in 2001 was that a new biosafety program, right? If we were going to get really concerned about biological weapons being deployed against us, and that was also going to help us deal with kind of surveillance for food-based illnesses and figure out emerging diseases as well. And you know, none of that happened either. And I think that gets at some of what Casey was talking about too, is that you know the even when there's a veneer of rational decision making or you know decisions made based in sort of an immediate panic that we hope will have ramifications
we still have trouble making large decisions and that will span decades and moving large masses of bureaucracy and people. Well, we have to take a short break. We'll come back, talk lots more with Casey Cole, Adam Rogers, John Rennie, and Baron Lerner. So stay with us. We'll go right to the phones when we're back and take your calls. Get your suggestions for the top science, health, medicine, technology, mathematics, whatever I'm leaving out, you put in. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the year's biggest science stories with my guests, Casey Cole, science commentator for KPCC in Pasadena, Adam Rogers, senior editor at Wired Magazine in San Francisco, John Rennie, editor-in-chief at Scientific American in New York, and Baron Lerner, author of When Illness Goes Public, Celebrity Patients and How We Look at Medicine. That's an interesting topic. We're going to have you back and talk about that because I think it's a truly interesting topic. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Barry in Boston. Hi, Barry.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Great show.
Thank you.
My question is about physics, the year in physics. In previous recent years, I've gotten a lot of pleasure from reading books about string theory, say, by Brian Greene. And it really captured my imagination, putting together Einstein's gravity and quantum physics using little tiny teeny things.
Right.
This year, two books came out, I believe, one of them by Lee Smolin, and I'm not sure the other author, but it was titled Not Even Wrong. And you get from the title books about string theory kind of debunking it or maybe saying it's barking up the wrong tree. What do your physics comment?
Yeah, it's come under a lot of string theories as being hit left and right. Let me go to Casey and then John, and I'll go to my panelists. Casey, what do you think?
Okay, well,
has it had its time and it's run out?
No.
It has the string run out. Oh.
No, it's a very difficult set of problems that they're working with. But these two books did make a very big splash, and I have to admit that I wrote one of the most negative reviews, as was the New York Times review, in that it is so easy to sit back and criticize, really, by people. The other author was Peter Voigt, who has a website, Not Even Wrong. By people who really aren't that much in the middle of it. Both of the books had a little bit of the flavor of I'm not invited to your meetings, I'm not in your club, nobody's paying attention to my theories. You get the impression that you have to be an insider. The thing about string theory is that even string theorists will tell you nobody exactly knows what it is. It's a way of solving this incompatibility between gravity and the large-scale universe and the small-scale universe. But it has had so many mathematical successes that most people are fairly convinced there's something there, even if they're not sure what. And what a lot of these books were also addressed at was basically poo-pooing math, as if, well, you know, it's just mathematics. It's just mathematics, which goes against a long history of math discovering real things, like antimatter, for example. So lots is going on in string theory. It's just that these two books coming out at the same time with the same complaint did get a lot of press attention.
John?
Keep reading about string theory.
These are not the first critics of string theory.
No, that's right. And I mean, it will continue to have a lot more in the future. You know, string theory is it's the big one on the block. It's the theory currently that everybody would have to knock over. It's what they have to beat to come up with something that is a better theory. I think string theory, it has contributed a lot, and there are legitimately questions, of course, about, you know, string theory. There are many, many different formulations, and there are questions of how do you settle on what is the best one. But really, somebody's got to come up with a theory that clearly works better than string theory does to be a serious criticism.
Also, I'm not sure it's fair to criticize Smolin's book, at least, as being, you know, an outsider who just says, well, I don't get to come to that party, so they must all be jerks. I mean, he had published in String Theory, and also, like, that's a little bit, Casey, that's a little bit of an ad hominem, right? I mean, the substance of the book is very solid.
Well, yeah, if you talk to string theorists, they would say that throughout the book, the success of loop quantum gravity has been vastly exaggerated compared to string theory. I think one of his big complaints, which is something that bothers a lot of people in the physics community, is just what Ira mentioned, the fact that string theory has probably an infinite number of solutions. So you're left with the problem of, is there a right solution? Why are we living in a universe that looks like this when it could look in just about any other way? And several physicists have come out in favor of the anthropic principle, which I'm sure we must have talked about that before. The idea is that we live in the universe we do because if it were any different, we couldn't live here. And that is very bothersome, and he really does have a legitimate point on that.
All right, we'll pick it up, Barry, later on, because we love talking about string theory. Thanks a lot. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Palo Alto, where Stephanie is. Hi, Stephanie.
Yes, hello, good morning.
Good afternoon.
I hope I can explain this nice and clearly. Diabetics who are dependent on several injections of insulin are now freed from the constant jabbings of the needle. This year, a new product was approved by the FDA and by the European authorities, whereby the patients take insulin into their bloodstream through the lungs by inhaling the insulin. It took 15 years to develop this, or at least it took a great number of years to get the FDA to approve it because they were nervous about breathing this stuff in through the lungs, but it seems to have proved to be no problem at all. And so diabetics who frequently postpone taking the insulin because they don't want to keep jabbing themselves, hopefully will start on the medication sooner before they start having serious side effects from the diabetes. So we think that this is a very exciting new development.
Dr. Lerner, you want to comment?
Yeah, it is very exciting, although one of the interesting aspects of it is that patients have not embraced it, and I think physicians as well, as quickly as we might have imagined. And for years and years, for example, many of my patients have complained about the needles over and over again. And when I raised this, they were like, "Oh no, I wouldn't do that."
Why? It's
part of it. It's new. There has been this discussion. It hasn't been around long enough. Are there possible long-term side effects in the lungs? And even though the FDA has been pretty reassuring about that, there are concerns.
Yeah. Stephanie, are you a diabetic?
No, I'm not. Actually, I'm the mother of the man who developed it.
Oh.
There.
Hey, full disclosure. Well, wait a minute.
Well, that's nice of his mom to come on.
But I think that this is really an exciting thing, and it's going to take time, I understand, from my son to educate the patient population on the use of the product. And it has been in trials for quite a number of years, and so far there have not been any contraindications. It seems like a very, very exciting new technology.
Well, you're a terrific
mom to call in.
Yeah, you're a terrific mom.
I'm a terrific mom. I'll tell my son.
Yeah, tell him to give us a call. All right. Thanks, Stephanie. Have a happy new year to you.
Thank you. Same to you. Bye-bye.
Right, another moment on Science Friday. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's move along. Let's go ahead to David in St. Paul, moving across the country.
Yeah, Ira, how you doing?
What kind of winter are you having this year, David?
Boy, I'll tell you, it's about 40-some-odd degrees. It's kind of freezing, not quite freezing rain. There's no snow on the ground, at least in the Twin Cities.
Wow.
So it's a very, very warm winter, actually. It's funny you were talking about the Large Hadron Collider. I remember, I think when I was coming out of college, going into the military, they were considering building something called the Superconducting Supercollider in Texas, which of course our government, in its infinite wisdom, decided to not fund. I'm eagerly awaiting the tune-up and then the final configuration, the beam configuration for the LHC, but my My story, I guess, is something that I guess it broke in the last couple of months, and that's the evidence, recent evidence for either contemporaneous or recent above-ground water flow on Mars. I think that that's
those
something.
Gullies. The picture of those gullies.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. The stains on the gullies, which had to be leftover mineral deposits in the water, something
right.
like that. Yeah, they were.
That's
amazing.
That's something that I think is. I mean, there's going to be a lot of work on that going on, and the ramifications, of course, if they do confirm that there has been water flowing above ground on Mars recently, I don't think those ramifications can be underestimated.
Yeah, that is certainly one of the most exciting sorts of planetary science discoveries of this past year. You know, any water that's flowing across the Martian surface is very short lived. Mostly that any kind of water that's there near the surface is frozen. You may have something like permafrost, and you may get some periodic melting just below the surface, and then a sort of an ice dam may break, and you may see some sort of flow. Mm-hmm. It certainly is one more thing that reinforces the view we have that Mars was a much wetter planet at one time. I think everybody would love to be able to take the jump and say, this must mean then that the odds for life in the past, or maybe in at least some primitive form on Mars, must still be pretty good. But we really don't know much about that. I mean, even beyond just the impossible to peg probabilities associated with life on another planet anyway, there's a very good possibility that, for example, the pH of that water may be way off. That water might be highly acidic, for example, too acidic to mm-hmm. imagine that you would easily get life forms evolving in it. But that's something we'll find out mm-hmm. about more over time.
Thanks for calling, David. 1-800-989-8255. Casey, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that it was interesting when I had actually been forwarded news reports about that and looked at them, and they basically said this has been discovered, and the interpretation is that there was water recently flowing. But if you actually read what was said, it was that was one very probable interpretation. So I think that's something you have to keep in mind. But also that, I mean, one of the really sad things about the way the budget priorities have been shuffled around at NASA is that if we're interested in looking for life, one, we should be funding astrobiology more, and they've been cut. I mean, those are the people who actually figure out what life might be elsewhere and what it would look like. And also, you know, the Jupiter moon missions, where you have, you know, pretty good chance. Europa is a pretty exciting place to go. More exciting, I think, than putting a man back on the moon.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about science stories this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Were those cut, all the Jupiter missions, Casey, or were they just some of them?
They've been back and forth, the Jupiter icy moons, orbiters. They were gone, then they were back.
Maybe the new Congress will have something to say about.
Yes, I think they will. But in terms of what you can do in discovery, you can do so much more with robots.
Mm-hmm. Just a few more minutes to go. Let's go to Jerry in Mountain View, California. Lots of Californians calling in today. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi.
The new electric cars that are coming out, like the Tesla car that has 0-60 in 4 seconds and a 250-mile range with lithium-ion batteries. And the big thing is really the improvement of the lithium-ion, which is your gas tank. The car has been around for a while, but the lithium-ion is a big thing.
Yeah. Adam Rogers?
Yeah, wait. Tesla's awesome, right? I mean, it's a little outside my price point, but I mean, the interesting thing about the electric motor, right, is it and batteries like lithium-ion batteries, is they have a bearing on sports cars. Is a few things. First of all, like, you know, you want a sports car with a low center of gravity that sort of, you know, sits low and is heavy to the ground. So that's perfect if you're going to load in, you know, a couple hundred lithium-ion batteries, right? Then, another thing that you want is low-end torque. Well, electric motors are really good at generating low-end torque, right? They spin up very quickly. So
you just have to ride a subway to know that.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, and get, you know, pushed back in your seat or lose your grip on the strap, right?
Right.
So, you know, all these things, especially when you add in, venture capital billionaires and a lot of designers from Lotus, can produce a really nifty car, which, you know, aside from just the... I grew up in Los Angeles, and so that means a lot to me right off. But it also does... suggest, I think, a difference in approach, as John was talking about, an opinion about global warming and about green technologies and climate change, that the idea now has become, look, this stuff is happening, what are we going to do about it? And that ranges from figuring out more efficient photovoltaics to how do we build a really cool electric car? And I think the important thing is going to be, you know, to make sure that Tesla doesn't turn out to be DeLorean, right? I mean, put aside the drug scandal thing, but to see if they can actually build some other cars, too, that might actually be in my price range.
Do you think that if more Silicon Valley engineers turn toward the automotive industry, things might change?
Well, it's pretty to think so. I mean, I would hope so. But I think that, you know, they thought that about space, too, right? I mean, a lot of the Silicon Valley guys, including Elon Musk, who's also involved with the Tesla, right? Elon Musk made his money at PayPal, is involved with Tesla, and also involved in his own space venture, SpaceX. I think that, you know, the success that they have with their companies starts to make them think that they might try something in another field, too. I would love to see more involvement by these kind of smart engineers in the automotive industry, which already has a lot of smart engineers, right? I mean, these folks are not constrained by their intelligence. They're constrained by some economics issues, I think, that maybe you start to overcome when the price of oil gets above $50 a barrel and photovoltaics get better and lithium-ion batteries get better and, right?
I have about 1 minute to go. I mentioned at the beginning that there was the story that didn't happen being the hurricane season that we thought might happen. Any other story, one story come to mind, John, that didn't happen, that surprised you, that didn't happen this year?
Yeah, I'll mention something it was a story embedded inside a story that did get attention. There was a lot of headlines that went to the report that came out that suggested that by 2048 we could basically see the collapse of all the ocean's fisheries. But what the story that didn't really get the right attention inside there was the fact that that collapse was not just from overfishing or pollution. It was partly just the fact that you were seeing the biodiversity of the ocean start to drop off. That in itself caused more extinction events. That's a very important ecological finding and something that's going to be very important when we look at the kind of consequences for the future.
Well, I want to thank you all. Casey, unless you have something, 15 seconds, you can jump in on that.
Oh, just following on that, how many of the stories had ethical consequences that we need to consider, whether it's in terms of environment, nanotechnology, anything? Yeah.
We didn't even get into nanotechnology. I mean, it's such a cutting edge thing. We'll have to do this again soon. Thank you all for taking time to be with me today. Casey Cole, senior commentator for our KPCC Radio in Pasadena, visiting professor of journalism at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. Baron Lerner, Dr. Lerner's author of When Illness Goes Public, Celebrity Patients and How We Look at Medicine, also Associate Professor of Medicine and Public Health at Columbia University Medical Center's Mailman School at Columbia. John Rennie, Editor-in-Chief at Scientific American New York, and Adam Rogers, Senior Editor at Wired Magazine in San Francisco. All of you have a happy new year. We'll see you next year. Thanks for taking time to be with us. Our program is produced by Karen Vergoth, Anne-Marie Cunningham, and senior producer Annette Heist. Our directors are Sarah Handel in Washington and here in New York. Karen handled the directing job today. Flora Lichtman is our digital media producer. Our intern is Steve Orns. Carrie Wolfson and David Gura worked the phones for us today. And we had help from engineer Bob Carlson in Santa Monica. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We're blogging and podcasting. We've got links to MySpace and all kinds of things up there, and Squidoo, and you can. Science Friday is everywhere on video, so check us out, and we'll download all those stories. And we're collecting videos of yours, so please send them in. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.